Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks education and self-determination with the leaders of the African People's Socialist Party, Omali Yeshitela and Chimurenga Waller. A quick editor's note. Throughout this podcast and in a written introduction, you will see the word African used to describe what you may know traditionally as the Black community. The usage is a reflection honoring the will and verbiage choices of the aforementioned party, the political organization founded by Chairman Yeshitela. We begin the podcast with Doug giving us some more background on our guests. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode. Today, we're honored to welcome Omali Yeshitela, Chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, and Chimurenga Waller, the National Director of Organization for the African People's Socialist Party, to our podcast. The party is an international organization that Chairman Yeshitela founded in 1972. The African People's Socialist Party fights for freedom and self-determination for people of African descent globally, which, according to Chairman Yeshitela, requires struggling to eliminate the effects of colonial oppression of Africans globally, what we in the States refer to as institutional racism. The chairman was an activist in the Black Power movement in the 50s and 60s and was a member of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Yeshitela engaged in the most famous act of civil disobedience in Florida's civil rights movement when he tore a racist mural off a wall in St. Petersburg City Hall in 1966. He spent 2.5 years in prison and finally had his voting rights restored by Governor Jeb Bush in the Florida cabinet in 2000. That wall in St. Pete City Hall remains blank to this day. The party has a sister 501c3 organization called the African People's Education Defense Fund that creates and manages a variety of businesses and programs designed to address the huge disparities in health, education, and economic development faced by African people all over the world. Chimurenga Waller has long been the party's education expert and an articulate advocate for empowering African people to have control over how their children are educated. I hope you enjoy our discussion.
Our objective is to have absolute, total, unequivocal control of the lives. Our people must have that. And it is a struggle against colonialism. It's a process of reuniting the whole African nation that has been forcibly dispersed at gunpoint against our will, where false national consciousness have been imposed on us in various places around the world. Our struggle everywhere is tied to that. Our impoverishment, every place on the planet Earth, you will not find a place where the collective African collectively is doing well. There's a general condition of well-being for Black people. And it has its origin in this initial attack some 600 years ago by Portugal that began forcibly dispersing African people, turning Africa into a whole, as Marx called it, a warren for the commercial hunting of Black skins. So that's at the core. Now, at different times, our strategy, our movement toward the objective of total liberation. We want to unify Africa and the African people. We have organizations on the continent of Africa, in the Caribbean, throughout Europe, and the United States. That's what it is that we're fighting for. At different times, moving toward that objective has been different because conditions have been different and the consciousness of the people have been different. Right now, for example, you see a high tide of militancy and rising consciousness of African and other people in this country. And of course, the foundation of what you see is the motion of African people, as it is historically, as it has historically been in this country. Immediately subsequent by the murder of George Floyd, and so that something 13, perhaps 1,400 cities. In this country have experienced mobilizations, protests. Some of this stuff is unprecedented. And the US president, in a hole in the ground, under the White House with the lights off, as though people would not know he was there. The prestige of the United States has plummeted everywhere because of this. And we say plummeted, we recognize that it means it is part of a contest that the U.S. is perennially involved in with other countries and forces in the world. China is an example. Even the EU stepped out and made some kind of cautionary note to the United States. So it's in a hell of a situation right now. And the things that we would even call for today are a lot different from what they would have been a year ago. I mean, I spent more than 40 years now trying to rebuild from a military assault on our movement that killed Malcolm, killed King, killed members of the Black Panther Party, scores of people in prison. We don't know how many people. All this time I've been, you know, trying to rebuild, knowing that this day would have to come. First, we saw it in Ferguson. That was an extraordinary moment. In fact, for the time, it seemed that was the defining moment at Ferguson. And we went into Ferguson, and we've built in Ferguson. I don't know if you've seen any of the stuff we've done there, you know, Ferguson, St. Louis area. And now this moment is upon us. The fundamental contradiction is that this thing is leaderless, spontaneity reigns supreme, that there is no to-what end that's being manifest now, that the rulers of this country take advantage of that, and they're defining to-what end, like defund the police, is the rallying cry now, and not even recognizing what the police is as an instrument of state power. We respect the fact that the public school system in this country developed primarily through the work of Africans freed from colonial slavery, who needed more than anybody, I guess, or wanted more than anybody, this education. But there's no respect for it. There's no respect for the NAACP. Never has been. Never will be. And probably never will pretend to be again, just based on some diplomatic BS. We won't do that. So that's not an issue. What is an issue is the process of getting this power that mobilizes the African population in a way that the power can be fought for, even controlling existing institutions where people pay taxes, the people pay taxes to fund them. Because the majority of the people will not have access to the kinds of institutions that we'll be creating on our own.
Tim Rangwaller, you have been a longtime spokesperson for alternative ways to make sure that the African community is served through education. And we have all kinds of opportunities now opening up. So talk a little bit about how you envision the movement, the Eruv movement, the African People's Socialist Party. How do you envision an education working system working the way the chairman has articulated in terms of the big picture? What does it look like when that institution works the way it's supposed to work to serve the African community?
Like the chairman said, it's really about power. We've contended for many, many years that educating African children did not have anything to do with how many white people was in the room. And that's the line of the NAACP. Integrate here, cause busing here, do busing here. And we said that's not what black people were trying to get. What they were trying to do is educate the children. How you get there is where we had these wide differences in opinion and approach. And our approach is you have to have power over the control of who is being hired, what is being taught to the children, where it's being taught, and black people have to control that, just like they have to control the economics, have commerce in the African community. We have to control every facet of our lives. If we're going to see freedom and total liberation, we have to control our education as well. And of course, the Duke School Board did not agree with that. We did put in a, in 1998, we put in a charter school application that they said was the best, one of the best ones they ever saw. And then they denied it for the very reason that it was probably not going to be any white children in the school. So that was the reason. That was the reason they gave. I believe that it's still the same trajectory, but different, like the chairman said, in terms of what we're able, where we're able to go and what we will be demanding. On the education front, I think black community control of schools is still a demand that makes total sense. Not diversity, not integration, black people controlling what is being taught to our children and who teaches it. How the teachers are disciplined, how the school is run, all of that must be under the control of African people for us to say our children are truly being educated. Because even when you go to a charter school, essentially you have a private company teaching the same thing that the public schools teach. George Washington was your forefather. Abraham Lincoln was the person who freed the slaves. All this nonsense is being taught to African people. And education for African people, real education, means the ability to gain knowledge that's going to help you get your freedom. That's going to lead you down a path to African liberation and socialism. If you're not getting that in the education system that you're in, then you're not being educated. So that's where we stand. We have to have black community control of schools. And part of that, of course, with me having our own schools. There is no more options left. We can't say the school is going to be nicer and less cruel than they have been. Because all they come up with is just more ways to exploit our children, to destroy them in the schools. You can't do this and you can't do this. You can't wear African head wraps. It's still a colonial school system. No matter how much you reform it, it's still a colonial school system. So we must have black community control of school.
How's this going to happen? How you guys over the years have explored after school programs, you've done tutoring programs. With all the things going on right now, there's all these new opportunities in the movement. Do you see this as a chance to perhaps begin to open up schools, to expand things you've done in the past and build on that?
Yeah, I think it's a chance to do that, but I think it's a greater chance to open up people's minds, because I think people are able to hear things that they couldn't hear 20 years ago. They couldn't hear last week.
Yeah.
I remember having a discussion with an African woman, and we were in this big school board meeting, very contentious, and she was saying it should be half black and half white. That would be what she called education for black people. That's where she was 15, 20 years ago. And of course, we weren't there. We were saying, no, it's not about who's sitting next to you. That's not. Because the school board of Pinellas County are experts at one thing, and that's transportation. How to move people from one spot to another. But transportation is not the primary objective of a school system. So when you say our preeminent goal is diversity, I say that's crazy, that's nonsense. You shouldn't be a school board.
Yeah, but the problem, Tim, is that it's the logic of colonialism. And I think when we have this discussion, as if the school board is acting illogically, because they, it contends with the logic of colonialism. Colonialism requires this relationship. And even when I was growing up, I'm fortunate to have never gone to like a so-called integrated, desegregated school. I'm fortunate that I've seen just the damage done to our children, the lies that have come to be recognized as truism. I mean, I remember when I was in fifth grade, and the teachers, because you were going to go to junior high school, it was called, and teachers are saying, soon you're going to be going to school with white people. And wow, you got to know all this stuff because you're going to be with white people. You understand? How the hell did this happen? You know? And but the logic of colonialism. And then we had, at that time, it was more like a neo-colonial situation because the principals were African.
Right.
It was almost like, in some instance, it had some characteristics of even, more aspects of colonialism, because, you know, there would be these, sometimes coming through, these white missionaries who would come through from time to time, and they'd actually set up in the classroom and teach missionary garbage, you know what I mean? It used to blow my mind. I'm a child. I'm in fourth grade, maybe, and I liked it because these was, you know, these white guys, strange people and things, so that was kind of exotic. That, and then what we had teachers who were able to say, you've got to get this for the race. That was part of what was said. That was the thing, that you're not just here for yourself, you know? But that's not even possible for a teacher to make that statement today, an African teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be teachers who would have a student to stand at the door to see if anybody's coming and say, this is what I want to tell you, and then teach. This is not on the curriculum, you know, but this is what you need to know. This is, you need to know who Hannibal was, who crossed the Alps with these elephants, and how the people who lived in the mountains ran down to the gates of Rome saying that there are men coming across the mountain with riding beasts as large as houses. I mean, I needed to know that, you know, and this is the kind, there's a lot. The freedom of education, this is something that needs to be understood. I mean, because we have absolutely different needs, we have so much that has to be brought back to us. I think I've had discussion with you before, Doug, how it's a ridiculous system anyway. The education process starts with the assumption that you're an empty vessel, that you don't bring anything to the process. Now, that's not good for anybody, but it certainly is horrible for Africans, because it means you have no culture, you have no history, you have nothing that you bring in. All this stuff gets poured into you. That's, which is one of the reasons people say, why don't Africans learn anything? Why the hell would you? I mean, it's a form of resistance. I mean, this is insane, this kind of stuff that they're pumping into your brain. And and what they've done is create a process that works efficiently to push out resistance. So any of the students who would resist, who would ask a question, who would fight back, get pushed out, to come through there with some element of level of success is to have a successfully audition to become a part of that part of the black community that would preside over the rest of us for white power.
You know, it's interesting, Mr. Chairman. You talked a lot over the years about police being an instrument of containment. And you've told me for years and years and years, the police aren't necessarily the root cause problem. I mean, the police are there to enforce the consequences of mm-hmm. enforced poverty and racism. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, there's a conflict. The cause of the conflict isn't necessarily police officers. The cause of the conflict is this system that's enforcing poverty and people naturally rebelling against poverty. Mm-hmm. And then the cops are there to represent the system to keep people in place. Same thing's happening in schools, as you know. There's a big debate right now about all the police presence in schools and all the criminalization. So as you're talking, I keep thinking that all fits together, right? You use the cops in the schools to basically contain.
But you remember when the cops went to the school, wasn't Columbine. Something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
It was a so-called desegregation.
Yes.
At the time where white students and white teachers were going to be on the campuses with black children, that's when the cops were necessary. They put the cops there. They weren't necessary. They did it. We
I mean, the fist fight was just a fist fight on the campus before then. Now it's a felony charge and things like that. Right. And so that's part of it. So it's a, you know, the fact is that you cannot maintain a colonial relationship without extreme violence all the time. And the state, the police. I mean, this thing, for example, as an example, George Floyd, that wasn't just a case of the police being there. The police are often in white communities too. This was a very grotesque, nasty act of colonialism. I've seen it represented with beheading. I've seen the consequences in Ferguson when they shot this kid and left them on 100 degree plus asphalt for 4.5 hours. Wasn't that they didn't have a way to move him, but it was a lesson for all those black people who lived in there. This is what happens to you if you go up against the state. And that's what colonialism is. It requires ongoing process of terror and violence to be able to maintain this relationship. And maintaining this relationship becomes an exacerbated need if you're going to starve the people.
Right.
If the people can't have any economic life, if you're going to, what white power calls, like this whole notion about, you know, they've put before, the schools are going to be like they are, relationships are going to be like they are, as long as housing is segregated. Then they say, Africans, what you got to do is integrate. Well, the oppressed cannot integrate with the damn oppressor. Mm-hmm. You just don't have the ability. Only the oppressor can be the integrating. And then when the oppressor integrates, what is it? Gentrification. We try to achieve what kind of democratic spaces we can in order to advance the struggle against colonialism. So if there's some space, for example, that we can utilize around creating a base to do education or anything like that, then we leap on that to build bases of power around that.
Anything else you'd like to share with the national audience about how important education is in the African community as it relates to opposing colonialism and empowering people, and anything else that I haven't asked? That,
well, definitely education as it relates to African people getting our freedom, because education that serves some other purpose other than African people getting their freedom is not education.
But education as such can't do that.
Yeah.
What has to do that is the party, is the organization in charge of the educational process, defining it, and collecting, you know, the power, you know, because otherwise, I mean, education can't do that.
Right.
You know,
right.
Who
controls it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, the first public school attendance requirement law was in 1852 in Massachusetts. It was in Massachusetts because the Protestants were freaked out about all the Catholics mm-hmm. coming in because of the potato famine in the mm-hmm. 30s and 40s and 50s. And so they used the schools to try to destroy Catholicism. And so that everybody would have to go to the school. It was controlled by the Protestants. So the whole history there is really schools of social control. But your point is, who's making that decision?
Yeah.
It can serve, those schools can serve all kinds of social engineering needs. Is it going to serve a social engineering of freedom, or is it going to serve a social engineering of oppression?
It can't do the freedom. I mean, you talk about, I don't know, I can't date the times when they start sticking indigenous children in these schools to make them white. I can't date that period, but that happened. It happened, you know, very serious assault on indigenous people. And it happens even today in some places around the world to make them white. So you have a social system that rests upon a foundation of colonialism. The whole system does. It's always been interesting to me to hear the leftists who discovered conveniently that they're in a struggle against the 1%, that we are the 99%. And what you are is full of shit, you know. You weren't part of the 99% up to now. And the fact is that the vast majority of the people on the earth are without water, clean water, without electricity, without streets and what have you, and in the world,
You know, 80% of the people on earth try to survive off $10 US dollars or less a day. That's 80% of the people on the planet. A lot of that is concentrated, like in places in St. Louis, when you factor it all out, you got people trying to survive, individuals, they may live in a household, assigned to survive off $5 a day. That's in St. Louis. So, you know, that's the reality that we're confronted with. That's the one we're tackling. So you talk about schools, talk about police, we're talking about all these other things. You talk about this mischaracterized food deserts and, you know, forms of population and resource control, which is absolutely necessary. It's a counterinsurgent thing to be able to food, the resource and population control. That's the fundamental strategy of counterinsurgency. You control the people like that. So it's not, it's a humongous struggle. And I think that we're living in a period where things is possible for many more people to understand this than it was, you know, just a little while ago.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that. How optimistic are you? There's a ton of sort of white liberals out there marching around thinking that, you know, they're changing the world. How do you take that energy and move it beyond this is, you know, you know what they're doing?
And that's an aspect of it, you know. And if you can get everybody to vote for Joe Biden in the process, I mean, while you're doing a brick, you know, remember vote for, and so
right on the brick.
I mean, and you know, people thought Obama was dead, you know, so suddenly he emerges and stay in the streets but vote, you know, and be nonviolent, that kind of BS. And so the problem for them is that they are the ones playing catch up in so many ways, trying to get in front of this damn thing as it's unfolding. They are really successful in some, to some degree. I mean, this whole Black Lives Matter mantra. I mean, what kind of demand is that? You got the House of Representatives on one knee with kente cloth. This is the most ridiculous. So the struggle that we're involved, but the thing is that the motion just gives us an opportunity, great opportunity to intervene and to take the science into the masses. And we're getting more and more recruits because of the consciousness, because people find us now much more easily. So the struggle is protracted, even though what protracted means is not something that's constant, you know? Because one of the things that we see is history is really condensed right now. I mean, what it took, I mean, I've been waiting for more than 40 years for this moment. We've seen occur in 3 weeks, more than what we saw happen in the last 40 years. It's a period that is ripe, as someone might say, pregnant with revolution.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if we can take all this energy and move it into, you know, systemic transformation.